The world is on the cusp of an energy revolution, but to avoid repeating the mistakes of yesterday's energy system, a new approach is needed to ensure that no one is left behind in the global energy transformation. I'm Lauren Reese, and you're listening to the New Security Broadcast from the Wilson Center's Environmental Change and Security Program. In today's episode, we're featuring remarks by Amos Hochstein made at a recent Wilson Center event. Amos is the Special Presidential Coordinator for Global Infrastructure and Energy Security, overseeing the U.S. government's activities in support of the G7's Partnership for Global Infrastructure Investment. A longtime leader in energy security, Amos is helping to build the scaffolding needed to support new supply chains for key components like critical minerals and rare earths in ways that strengthen the U.S.'s partnerships with countries around the world.
I could not be happier than to be here with Amos Hochstein for so many reasons, including that I've had a chance to see him at work, and so I'm going to ask him like horrible, tough questions that'll just ruin his day. Not really. But I think what I do want to say for the audience is you got from the intro that, you know, this is an impressive person who's doing an important job, but there are a lot of things you can't tell from a title or even from the way someone speaks. So I wanted to make sure you understand that Amos is one of these people who's, I mean, it's almost like the ghost in the machine. He is making things happen, and that's partly who he is, but that's also the position of trust he has in this government. So you may think, I haven't heard of that office, I don't know this program, but you do, because he's making things happen. So, in fact, I haven't seen him in a long time because of that, because he's been so busy. So I'm going to just dive right in and ask you a question. You know, my friends across the waters, and I'm talking about the Pentagon, not the other waters, refer to China as the pacing threat. It's not a term that I particularly care for because I think we should set our own pace. But talk to us about the program you're running. And is it an answer to the Belt and Road Initiative, or One Belt, One Road, as it used to be known? Is it an answer? Is it our own? What is it relative to China? And, you know, what's the purpose here of this program?
Thank you. Well, first, let me just say thank you for having me, Mark and Sharon, and of course to the Wilson Center. It's a great opportunity to have this conversation, especially with the two of you, with the work both that you've done in the past and that you're doing now in framing these kinds of discussions. I don't see the effort that we're doing as related to anyone, not to China, not to anyone else. Our job as the U.S. government is to address the critical interests of the United States, and within the context of the G7 and the world and the role that the United States plays around the world, is to make sure that we're doing what's in the interest of the rest of the world. And when these issues that we're discussing today, whether it's in infrastructure investment, whether it's in critical minerals, energy security, ICT and digital and telecom, all of these issues, it is true that China has made significant investments over the last 10 to 20 years, and that they have a dominant position in some of them in certain countries, in certain regions around the world, specifically sub-Saharan Africa, parts of South America, Central and South America, and even parts of Southeast Asia. But we shouldn't be doing what we're doing because China's doing it, or to catch up to China. What we need to be doing is to recognize what are the interests of the United States. And one, it is to fulfill the promise and the partnership that we need to have with countries in low-income and middle-income countries around the world, not just with wealthy countries. Two, we need to make sure that as we are going through a revolution in energy and a revolution in technology, that everyone around the world gets to benefit from it and rises at the same time, and that the supply chains around the world for those revolutions are diversified and secure. And so that's what I don't see this as pacing. I see this as really what is in the best interest of the American people, of the American economy, of the American government. And as a country that plays a leadership role in the world, what are we doing to make sure that everybody around the world is benefiting from these policies?
Let me ask you a follow-up question before we let Mark jump in. But you know, you talked about the kinds of infrastructure investments we need to make and about energy infrastructure and critical minerals. And this is all about the energy transformation that needs to happen, which is calls for a ton of money and a lot of effort. We just had the new UN report, I think came out yesterday or the day before, where it's not good news and we're running out of time. How do we do this? And how do we do this and make the trade-offs? You know, there's been a lot of press about that. We have a legacy energy system that supports a lot of our economy and a lot of the global growth, and we need to change it. Where are these trade-offs, and how do you make that investment?
So that's the hardest question. If we agree on the premise that the energy transition that we're really at the beginning of is probably the greatest economic transformation since the Industrial Revolution, of unplugging an entire energy system from one and plugging into another, and that it's not as simple as just unplugging and replugging, and that you have to build up a system from scratch. We're building renewable energy infrastructure, equipment, and then to deployment, that takes time. We need to make sure that that electric vehicles are deployed faster and safer. And we need to do that while we make sure that we still have a functioning economy, meaning that the legacy economy has to continue to function. So you can't just unplug from the first system until you're ready to plug into the other. That requires an enormous amount of coordination and logistics and strategy of how do you do two things at the very same time, which is what President Biden has been talking about doing. One, have to accelerate the energy transition in whatever means we can. And that's the purpose of passing the legislation so that we can do it here at home. It's to provide the financial incentives to do that. We have to seek out resources that will address this emerging need, and to accelerate it means I need everything that goes into these items. So someone once told me a couple years back, said, you know, once we get out of oil and gas and we get to sun and wind, all of our geopolitics of energy, all our sourcing is going to go away because nobody controls the sun and the wind. That's God or nature. I said, that's great, but the things that capture the sun and capture the wind and turn them into energy are controlled by someone. So we have to do this not only so that we have the items that we need, the products that we need, and the what's in the battery, what produces the cell, or what's inside the wind turbine, but who's making it, and how are they making it, and what's their control of that supply? And all of these decisions have to be made while we're making, you mentioned the UN report, while we're in an urgency of a climate crisis, and we need to still make sure that we have enough fuel and enough heating and electricity from oil and gas to last us through this energy transition. That's a really difficult balancing, and it has all these different plays to it that we have to address, and we do not have time. We have to address it immediately across the board of all of these different functions that go into it.
And I'll turn it over to Mark, but I'm going to leave you with something to stew on, or Mark can pick it up. But when you said, you know, all these things that it takes to capture the wind and the sun and make it usable for energy services, who owns it, who processes it, full circle, we know who it is. So I would love to take you back to critical minerals and the enormous task ahead of us. But we have so much to talk about, Mark.
Well, we should talk about critical minerals, because when you talk about making that transition in a hurry, mines don't happen in a hurry. They take time. And so we don't have time. And those electric cars are powered by batteries that have critical minerals in them that are some in America that we're working hard on accessing, but some around the world. So as we look at our infrastructure investment support efforts, which is a key priority of the WABA Institute for Strategic Competition, how do we have the tools? Can we know what is happening, an opportunity to access a mine, to develop a mine? And what kind of challenges are you overcoming to make sure that we're on a fast pace to secure as many sources of critical minerals as we can for this energy transition.
So I'll tell you, one of the most exciting things for me to work on coming into the administration is the area of critical minerals and energy, and not just critical minerals, rare earths, and all the things that go into the supply chain for clean energy. And that's because I started working on energy, you know, 25 years ago, and in the old world, in the 20th century world of dynamics and architecture of energy security meant geopolitics of energy, colored by dramatic events such as the our producers of oil boycotting the United States and not allowing us to have access to it, and what does that mean? And large parts of what happened from the 1970s onward was colored by that momentous event, creating the IEA, creating the Strategic Petroleum Reserves, working collectively together. We're falling back into the same architecture, where in the oil business you had an upstream that looked for the oil and produced it, the midstream that refined it, and the downstream that turned it into, whether it was into gasoline, selling it as gasoline or plastic or whatever. Now we have an upstream, which is the critical mineral mining or the rare earths. You have to refine them as well, or smelt them, or process them, depending on the product. And they got to put them into a battery, and then they got to go into a car. So we have to guard against creating the threats to our energy system that existed in the 20th century, once again in the 21st century. So we can't have the current system of where we are today. If you took a snapshot of where we are today, China today, through its work over the last 10 to 20 years, owns a respectable percentage of mines. They have an even larger percentage of refining and processing. And they would like to have a dominant position in battery manufacturing for vehicles. They already have a dominant position in solar manufacturing and a dominant position to some degree in wind. The IRA passage, the legislation, the Inflation Reduction Act, is the it's not only the biggest dollar-wise investment in clean energy that we've seen ever in the United States. It is also the very basic tool that we need to start changing this dramatically. And it has already had a major change in capital flows and decision-making by corporations around the world that are in the energy space, from that upstream all the way to the car company or the solar manufacturer. So we are going to have more mining in the United States. We're going to have more refining in the United States. We're going to have more battery manufacturing in the United States. We'll have more of those also with free trade agreement countries that countries that we have a free trade agreement with. But what we want is not to stop there. We want this not to have two hubs in the world. One is China, one is the United States. We want there to be multiple hubs of production of critical minerals all the way to the refining and the manufacturing, because we don't want North America to have one market and China to serve the rest of the world. And it's not because I have anything against China in this, from a macro perspective. They have a right to be in this business, and they're going to be, and they're very good at it. But we cannot have a monopoly and a dominant position in the energy sector as we're building a new one, just to go through the same problems that we had and the same national security risks that we had in the 20th century. So what do we do about it? We have to invest across the board. We can't come into countries and say, I just want your resource. That is not going to work. So when you talk about, Mark, the investment in infrastructure, I don't see a difference between the investment in hard infrastructure, ports, roads, rail, and mining. And I don't see the difference between investing in non-Huawei telecom infrastructure that has, as we go to 5G, that is from trusted vendors, not just American, whether it's Nokia or Ericsson or Samsung, doesn't matter. These are all interconnected. If you want to run an energy system, an electricity system, in the 5G era, it will matter what infrastructure you have. So suddenly telecom and electricity are the same. And if you want to produce and increase mining, you want to have the efficiency to be able to do that. And that means to have the kind of ports that can manage it and rail that can bring the equipment in and out and product in and out. And we have to make sure that that we give governments an option. I'll close with this. I'm sorry for taking long on this one question. It drives the entire thing. We shouldn't come to countries and say, work with our companies or work with us just because it's us. We should do it because we have a better offer for them, not for us. So we should be able to say to a country, if you're going to have a mine that's up for grabs, that's up for a bid, ask yourself a few basic questions. Is the company that is going to bid on this, that will probably have the best bid financially on paper, are they going to bring their workers with them, or are they going to hire local? If they hire local, are they going to train so that they're executives, or are they going to make them the lowest end of the employee pay? Will they pay them more than 50 cents to a dollar a day? Will they employ children? Will they pay them a pension, provide health care? And after a couple of years, when those workers walk home, are they going to walk home on a dirt road in the dark to a house without electricity in a town that has no school and a city that has no health care? If that's what's happened, you failed. But I'm the failure if I'm not able to provide, and I as the United States, I as the G7, I as the industrial world, if we're not proposing companies and convincing companies to come in who have better reputations, who are going to work with better standards to develop this new world of energy. And to do that, who's going to invest in a mine if it's not connected by rail, it's not connected to a port, it's in a landlocked country where the conditions of transparency are not great, and now you're telling me I can't even get my product out in an efficient manner, which brings about much more problems and chances for corruption and everything else that comes with it. So we have to say to countries, the critical minerals is not us coming and taking the asset away, but rather, how do we use this to build a better diversified economy that is better for your people? And that we can say we are building a new, greener, cleaner economy that is on the back of fair labor, higher standards, environmental protection for the land that they're on. That's what we should be striving for, and I think that's what President Biden is trying to do. That was the promise in the Africa Leader Summit, in our travels at the G20 in Indonesia, and how we're working with some of our allies and partners in South America. That's the world we need to create, and that's what we've launched a year ago, and I think we're on our way to be able to deliver on that.
And just as a quick follow-up, that's a tall order. That's a big task, and it's going to take a lot of folks to get that done. The G7 has come together, I believe, with that shared vision. How do you see those G7 partners, as well as we have similar arrangements with AUKUS, how do you see our partners helping us and collaborating towards that common vision? Because I think they share the same vision that you just outlined.
I think they absolutely do. And here's where we need to collaborate. One is we have to get MDB reform, right? We have to have reform in the international institutions that provide finance, because that is going to help us unlock the private capital that needs to come. We can't finance all of these infrastructure projects just on government money. The task is enormous. And the private sector funding, from private equity to hedge funds to banks in the United States and around the world, and the G7 in particular, are not investing in low and middle income countries. But at the end of the day, they're not ideological organisms, they are financial ones. So if we can de-risk those investments, if we can provide the support so that they're not afraid of all three of the ESG components, and doing that through multilateral development banks, through governmental export and financial support institutions, then we can bring them along with us, then we can really unlock. And we're seeing that, so that's one area that we can collaborate. The second is identifying these projects. The one thing that democracies lag behind autocracies is autocracies are really fast. One guy makes a decision, one woman makes a decision, and the check is cut. we have to do due diligence and have to do all the other work that we have to make sure where the money's going, who's getting it, et cetera. That means it's slower, but it still means that it's worthwhile. So by collaborating, we can make sure that when projects are coming up for bid, it may not be an American company, it may be a German company or an Australian company or a French or a British or Italian, it doesn't matter. We are all there supporting each other so that there is this diversified ecosystem. I find myself constantly advocating and promoting non-American companies when that's all there is. And because we need, and we're expecting that our partners and allies will do the same thing in their countries or in others for American companies so that we can have that diversified platform.
You know, when the president announced this, I think over the summer, I think with the G7 announcement of the Global Partnership for Infrastructure and Investment, it's a mouthful, you know, the acronym of
PGII,
Okay, picky?
Catchy.
Okay. No, great program. But one of the things that was really interesting about the announcement was the exemplars of the projects were, one was from the Defense Finance Corporation, one was from the U.S. Agency for International Development, and of course, you know, DOD has the Defense Production Act. There are a lot of pieces, mm-hmm. almost too many pieces. Department of Interior, U.S. Geological Survey under them, Department of Energy. We haven't had a governance structure for supply chain and for critical minerals in particular. I assume that's part of the reason your job was created, was to be an integrator of that. How are we going to do that going forward? Like, those are a lot of pieces. Are the pieces all on the same page?
So first, I think the pieces are absolutely on the same page. I think it's easy when the biggest champion for this kind of initiative is the president. That helps a little bit. And he is very, very focused on this as both a concern and a threat to our national security, not just our economic security, and as are leaders in other countries. And I think that you're right that we have multiple institutions and that have the ability to mobilize finance on behalf of the U.S. government. But that's how our system's built. If we try to come and say, you know Washington as well as anyone, if I went to the Hill today and said, let's create a whole new organism that's going to do this and fund it at a certain level, then in 2030 we will be doing something. But instead, we just passed three pieces of legislation that give us an enormous opportunity. It's not just the Inflation Reduction Act, it's the CHIPS Act, and it's the Bipartisan Infrastructure Act. Right. These are, when you put them together,
generational legislation.
These are massive changes because of how much money they are mobilizing and incentivizing.
Yeah.
So if you're going to start building all these things here in the United States, because suddenly it's you've taken technologies that were, you know, questionable whether they were yet at the point of financial viability, and suddenly you made them financially viable, and now the investment is flowing, well, now that is going to invigorate a supply chain conversation. Some of us have been having this conversation and the threat of a unipolar dominant force in clean energy supply for several years. But in the last 9 months, we have seen a far more robust discussion across governments, civil society, and corporate on the supply chain question. Why? Because all of a sudden I'm building these factories. Well, where am I going to get the stuff? So suddenly I have to focus on how am I going to get it? Where is it coming from? What's the equity part of it, right? So there's all these questions that are rushing. So what have we done with these three pieces of legislation? We have taken things out of the normal financial and economic cycle mm-hmm. of a technology, bringing technology to market. And we've accelerated and compressed it. And now we have to make sure that we have everything that comes along with it. So what we have to do is deal with the institutions that we have. My job, as you said correctly, is to coordinate the different efforts from the DFC, from the Ex-Im Bank, and MCC, and USAID, and Department of Energy, and all of those efforts combined, together with KfW in Germany, and DFAT, and all the other institutions around the world. And we all work together to identify, okay, how can we mobilize capital to these different projects? And some of them we're seeing projects that we are advocating together on lithium and batteries that will mobilize American projects that have in them now, a French, a German, an American, and an Italian company with an Australian. This doesn't happen overnight and doesn't happen and never happens on its own. But when we can collaborate, what I'll tell you this one last thing. When we compete, when there's a bid, and there's an actual competition, we win almost every time. But there are a lot of bids in a lot of places, and we have to mobilize a lot of companies that are not used to working in these environments. The number of dollars that are invested, of the trillions that were announced on climate, are more and more invested in OECD countries. The number of dollars that are invested in non-OECD countries is declining. And we have to change that. And this is the opportunity. I've said it before, the energy transition is an Africa is an opportunity for an Africa transition. And that's where we can all come together to work on this. And I think we have the tools. It's about implementing them.
So besides the energy transition, if you think of another area where it's vital to the development of a nation that we would be partnering with, it's vital to our economy, and it also has security dimensions, is in the communication space. Mm-hmm. And the communication space is innovating at a very rapid pace. So there are the traditional providers you already mentioned, Nokia, Ericsson, Samsung. There's Open RAN, which is opening up a whole new suite of providers. There's low Earth orbit satellites that are allowing satellite communications. What opportunities you see, what challenges do we need to overcome in order to make sure that there's a secure communications backbone around the world, not just here at home?
So step one, I think, is to understand and to get a uniform understanding of the concern and why we should care about this. And when you move, when you're deploying infrastructure and technology and software in this space, and you do it with a non-trusted vendor who will use the ability to be in your system to not just from a national security invasive and therefore create national security threats, but mostly for corporates will create that threat of information gathering and privacy and lack of privacy protection. So there has to be a understanding of that level of concern. And that's in across every industry. And what I would hate people to think is that this is a government problem. It is not. The increase in cyber attacks is not just against governments. Energy industry is actually one of the most prone for these attacks, but they're happening against everything, from hospitals to schools to other corporations. So having secure telecom systems doesn't just mean government secure, but just trusted vendors that you can work with. Now, what's happened with Huawei is that they have come in and invested over the last 10, 20 years in the infrastructure at 2G and 3G, and now they want to do the upgrades into 5G. And 5G is not just an upgrade of 4G, it's a completely different technology that has far, far bigger implications because of the capabilities. So we want to make sure that there are opportunities for a diversified portfolio of companies and technologies. We want to make, and that they're not taken out of the market by essentially dumping with offering at near zero costs sometimes to get into the system, because, you know, the first check is zero, but then you're hooked for life on that technology. And to have a different offering. So we're doing two things in that. One is encouraging and bolstering specifically on the 5G side, alternatives and making sure that it's diversified. Again, we're not selling, this is not America coming and saying buy America. It's buy anything that is from a trusted vendor. Second is encouraging the advancement of Open RAN that you mentioned before to have a more open platform that in and of itself is more secure and that develops into an alternative and to the existing platforms and could then compete because of its nature, in its open nature. And we have done that through U.S. government agencies. We are working with providers and companies, technology innovators in the United States, in Japan, in across Europe to advance Open RAN again, to accelerate the adoption, perhaps faster than it would have been. Telecom moves at a slower, the development of telecom generations of technology happens at a slower rate than other parts of high tech. And what we'd like to see is Open RAN catch up a little bit faster to be able to provide that kind of an alternative. We see a lot of success in this. We have been a funder through US government of alternative companies that are willing to work in Africa. And I can tell you that in the case of one of those companies, when they entered Angola, by the time, within 9 months of being on the ground and opening up for services, they were able to achieve over 40% market share. So again, it's about, we can't force anybody to buy anything. But if you offer that alternative, we think that it was gonna work. And from my experience over the last year and a half of doing this, when we offer that alternative, when we come in with some financial, not grants, but financing, we win almost every time.
You've been listening to the new security broadcast from the Wilson Center. Thanks for tuning in. For more information, follow us on Twitter @NewSecurityBeat and visit newsecuritybeat.org.